raging elements, fighting the savage wilderness, striking at the enemies of man and nature. One man's name resounds from snow-capped mountains down across the sun-baked plains.
William M. Briggs.
Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Hi, everybody. This is William M. Briggs, and today is the 12th of December, 2014, a date which marks the triumphant and glorious return of this podcast back to the airwaves after a hiatus of only a 5 short years. Happy birthday, Frank, incidentally. Today we're going to talk about peer review and why it is not nearly as exciting as civilians think it is. We're going to have a statistics lesson by Bob and Ray, and we're going to talk about the latest fad in academic philosophy, which is the killing of live babies. Stick around.
Anything you can buy, I can buy cheaper. I can buy anything cheaper than you.
50 cents?
40 cents.
30 cents?
20 cents.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can say, I can say softer.
I can say anything softer than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
I can drink my liquor.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. The show originates at wmbriggs.com. That's wmbriggs.com. This is William M. Briggs. I hope to be able to bring these podcasts to you about once a week. I'm not going to promise that. I'm going to try to get them out at least bi-weekly at first and then aim for once a week. Try to establish some regularity. Right now, they're going to only be available on the site and possibly YouTube, and then later iTunes. I had an iTunes account at one time for the old podcasts, but that died away as I neglected this show for some 5 years. So let's talk about peer review. I had a Twitter follower ask me about this site called pubpeer.com. It's a new way of doing peer review, or so they say. Now, I have been an associate editor at Monthly Weather Review. I was an associate editor for a number of years, back before I became an apostate, heretic, blasphemer about my stance on global warming. But during that time, I was an editor of several papers, mostly of statistical content. I've had nearly 70 papers myself go through the peer review process where I was author or co-author. And I have reviewed, I don't even know how many papers from other colleagues sent to me by editors and of journals and grant committees and so forth. So I'm familiar with the process. I think peer review is an extraordinarily crude filter. It tends to create a process whereby mediocrity is encouraged, and in fact is seen. Scientists are people like anything else, and backbiting, bad feelings, ununderstanding, lack of understanding, I should say, dim-wittedness, everything applies. That for regular human nature applies for podcasts. Now, I should note there'll be a slight symphony in the background given my proximity here on the Upper East Side on the island of Manhattan to various hospitals, and there is no way in this apartment studio of mine that I can quench all of the sounds, so you're going to be hearing them just as I am. Now, peer review is an interminable process. Civilians tend to think of it as a guarantor of accuracy when it is anything but. There are several fields, as those who follow the website, wmbriggs.com, know that certain areas are error-plagued and error-prone, and no amount of peers who are committing the same errors as their fellow peers are going to fix it. About the best approach I've seen to peer review is archive.org. That's ARXIV.org. Now, that has a very minimal filter. Basically, you have to have approval from some colleagues or peers to be able to post articles on the site. And once you have that, you can simply post articles. There's a weak filter after the fact to make sure that the articles you put up are in the right bucket. But beyond that, not much happens. And their papers are freely available for all to read, all to reject, or all to accept, as is their proclivity. Another way of doing peer review, and the way I have adopted, is to have blog posts and to write books. Anybody can come and criticize any blog post. Anybody can come and read what I have to say, and any peer can and do comment. And this is an ultimately very fair way of doing things. And it's one way for the word to get out about what you find and what you need. Now, the thing about peer review is the process is necessarily pegged to the average content of papers. Now, as the university system has expanded, as the money has washed into the system from governments the world over, more and more people are doing research. And even professors at what used to be called liberal arts colleges, where the teaching of students was preferred, insist on scholarship, which is to say they insist on their professors writing papers that nobody is going to read, and or very few people are going to read. And this tends towards a system of mediocrity as well. But the problem is we have so many papers and journals that have flooded the system that any paper can get a home. There are journals out there that are created almost daily, even scam journals, many scam journals, typically from, a lot of them tend to be from India or Nigeria, where any article is accepted as long as you can pay for the page charges. Well, that's neither here nor there. These gentlemen at pubpeer.com, P-U-B-P-E-E-R.com, have a new way. They allow people to come and discuss any paper anonymously. Now, I'm not a big fan of the anonymity part of it, but what they say is, let me quote from this article from Wired.com, which you can find on the show notes. They say, quote, "The problem is that today's peer review is a broken process. Too often errors slip through, and they can go uncorrected for years. Even if they are eventually exposed, that's often long after other researchers or clinical trials have relied on them," end quote. Now, that's a fact. That last part is the important part. As papers are out there and then others cite them, they become suddenly a body of literature, which soon moves into the realm of unquestionable. And this is in particular in fields, it's very often found in fields which David Stove, the late philosopher, the late great Australian philosopher, called the intellectual slums, like education and sociology and even, unfortunately, psychology. Now, these guys, they wanted to improve the peer review process, and they say they wanted to accelerate the exchange of ideas. Well, that sounds very nice. So what I thought was interesting was the anonymity, and they say, well, I'm not a big fan of the anonymity. They think that this is going to encourage people to speak out, and while that's undoubtedly true, it's going to encourage people to say any number of things that they can't be held to. And it's going to probably encourage sniping, and as proof for that, I just logged onto the site today. One of the top articles that is under discussion, at least as I'm reviewing it, was macroscopic observability of spinorial sign changes under 2π rotations. Well, I can't speak English. The article is by one Joy Christian from the International Journal of Theoretical Physics. And it has a number of comments, 56 so far. And one person calling himself Richard Gill says this paper contains a hidden disproof of Bell's theorem. There's a sign error. And a quick Google search does suggest this subject has already been been extensively discussed. And there's lots of this sort of paper. You know, I'm not here to talk about this particular paper. But eventually it became like many blog posts become. It devolved into meaningless name calling and sniping. The very last comment at press time here is, ladies and gentlemen, is this really how scientists behave? The person asked. And I tell you, yes, this is exactly how scientists behave. My God, most scientists are very happy to snipe at other scientists behind their backs, particularly behind their backs. There's no greater fun than academics have than gossiping about other academics, which is why I don't like the anonymity. I like to have everything right out in the open. Well, that's peer review for us. I mean, there's 101 more things we could talk about it. I think this is an interesting experiment that they have. I like archive better, and I like that in combination with books and with blog posts, and I'm not a big fan of journals anymore. They're expense, for one thing. Many people don't understand, civilians don't understand, you have to pay to get into many journals. You pay page charges, you have to do your own editing to some extent, you have to do your own typesetting. The system is screwy, to say the least. And the biggest scams, incidentally, if you're thinking open source publishing is going to solve this problem, the biggest scams come in open source publishing because those systems all have page charges, and the page charges are where people are thinking they're going to score some easy money. Well, it's an enormous subject, and that's all we're going to say about it right now. Before we continue on with our next topic of academic philosophers talking about how best to kill, let's have a little statistic lesson from Bob and Ray. This is an interview from Bob and Ray from many years ago. Enjoy.
You see, I calculated the probability of you wanting to interview me at about 7 chances out of 9. Is that loud enough?
It's a little too loud. All you right. Just tone it down just all a little right. Bit.
So I just knocked down a few ushers to get up here in case you hadn't taken the time to figure out the odds yourself.
Well, of course, you realize nothing you just said makes very much sense to me.
I assumed that would be your reaction 96 times out of 100. And by failing to buck the odds, all you've done is increase the known probability factor without even realizing
it. Well, I'm not surprised. I've been talking to you for almost a minute now, and if we have any topic under discussion, I don't realize what it is.
Well, Mr. Elliott, and I call you that on the 50% assumption that the other one is not Mr. Elliott.
All right.
I happen to have worked out a foolproof system for computing the mathematical chances of everything.
Oh.
And it's your good fortune that I'm now going to share my discovery with the world right here, on your show.
Well, I don't know whether that's a good fortune or not, but I guess you have the figures to prove I'm wrong, right?
Yeah, now by splitting the glory 50-50, the odds are 8-5 that neither of us will be remembered after the other one is forgotten. See?
Well, in that case, why don't you just take all the glory and let me be the long shot?
Mr. Elliott, I don't believe you're taking this thing seriously. Do you realize that my life expectancy is greater than yours just because I discovered that 1,000 times more accidents occur in the home every year than on commercial bus lines?
Well, how could finding out a ridiculous thing like that increase your life expectancy?
I moved into a bus. Fortunately, I didn't have any family responsibilities to hold me back. With wives outliving their husbands by a margin of 8-1 in this country, I never bucked the odds and got married.
Well, now, in other words, you've used your theory to turn your own life into a shambles, and now you want to share the benefits with our audience?
Well, it's not just a question of what I want to do. I figure I've got a moral obligation to help people take the guesswork out of living. I didn't spend almost a year flipping a coin 5 million times just to keep the results to myself, you know.
Boy, you flipped a coin 5 million times. What did that prove?
Nothing very conclusive, except that when you toss a half dollar in the air, it'll wind up rolling under the couch more often than you'd expect.
Well, I figured.
The same way with cracks in the sidewalk. People with small feet actually step on more of them than people with big feet because they take shorter strides, thereby increasing the likelihood.
Uh-huh. Life is full of all kinds of surprises, I guess, isn't it?
Not only for those who leave things to chance. Now, in my case, I already know that if I'm bitten by a dog today, it'll probably be a Doberman pincher. That if I jaywalk, I'm not likely to be run down by a marmon or a Pierce arrow. And that if I don't clear out of here within 15 seconds, The chances are 2 out of 3 that the usher, you're wig-wagging to, will break my arm.
My guess would be 9 out of 10 that it'll be both arms.
Oh, well, I suppose the probability could be that great considering my nuisance factor and the likelihood that my figures are all wrong because I'm terrible at arithmetic.
Right, so leaving of your own free will is certainly your best bet, Mr.
Einstein. Alvin Einstein. The third, which proves that whatever it is, the chances are at least 12 to 5. It's not hereditary. Goodbye.
Incidentally, if you haven't heard Bob and Ray before, there's a link in the show notes. You can find many more episodes and clips. Now, it seems appropriate. I don't know if you can hear it, but there is yet another ambulance passing by to talk about a medical topic. Now, you wouldn't have guessed, I don't think, that the Journal of Thoracic and Cardiovascular Surgery would be a place discussing the best way to kill newborn babies, or babies that are not so newborn, but that aren't yet old enough to escape on their own from the ministrations of those who would put them out of their misery. And I do not joke, nor jest. The article editorial that we're interested in here today, and that's linked on the show notes, is from a guy who calls himself Udo Schuklenk, or Schuklenk. I'm not exactly certain how to pronounce it. It's a German name. I have the link to his website. He is an academic philosopher from Queen's University in Canada, the Department of Philosophy, of course. I have some clips coming up from him in a few moments discussing matters very similar to this, but for a moment we're going to talk about this essay that he has in the journal. And the title of the essay is Physicians Can Justifiably Kill Certain Severely Impaired Neonates. Now, he didn't use the word kill. He used the euphemism euthanize, which sounds much more pleasant than kill. He brings up a scenario of a newborn with heterotaxy syndrome. Now, that is a case of organs being born in the wrong place. They're all there, but they're shifted. The heart's not shifted to the left. It's displaced to the right. And while these kids typically won't survive without some form of intervention, some can, very minor cases, of course. Others require surgery. There's drugs. Any number of things can be done. It's not the most pleasant thing for a kid to have. The prognosis is untreated. Death can be soon or up to a year, sometimes more. I'll post a link on the show notes so you can read about it. It's not really the point of this article because it's just a jumping point. There are many, of course, illnesses that humans can suffer, and this is just one of them. Now, the interesting thing is that Schuklenk wants to have these kids killed. Slit their throats, throw them off buildings, into the dumpsters, whatever it's going to take to remove life from them. Now, he says, and I'm quoting from his article now, "What makes cases such as this morally circumspect in the eyes of many," and I'll interject my own note here, it's certainly morally circumspect in my eyes. Let me return to his article. "What makes cases such as this morally circumspect in the eyes of many is that, unlike with competent adults, a neonate has no a current capacity to express his reflective wishes." I'm still quoting. "There are no reflective wishes, not even a reflective interest in continuing existence," end quote. Now, I found some of the words in here interesting, including competent adults. And the interesting thing is what he is trying to do is say, since the infant can't stick up for himself, it's okay to kill it. The infant can't express wishes, therefore it's okay to kill it. Now, we all know, those competent adults among us anyway, know that humans take quite a long time to mature. And even children up till 3, 4, 5 years of age aren't able to express their reflective wishes very well, even in continuing existence. So this criterion of his, if it were to be adopted, could be very broadly applied, and not just to children. It could apply to those adults with dementia, Alzheimer's. It could apply to those adults who are suffering from a coma, or rather, who are in a coma. It could even apply to those adults who are sleeping, or those who have passed out drunk, or are in other ways unable to express reflective wishes in continuing existence to the satisfaction of buffoons like Schukirk. Now, the point of this is that you cannot have a criterion like this and be considered sane, I think. Now Schukirk is in Canada, and Canada has these things called human rights commissions, and human rights commissions are all for the rights of some and not at all for the rights of others. So I have to tread careful ground here lest I get called up to Canada and have my back bacon taken from me. He has a section in the paper called Sanctity of Life versus Quality of Life. All right, this is important. This is sort of developing his theme. Now, he says, quote, "For most Christian ethicists, this question is relatively easily settled. Human life from the moment of conception is of infinite value. And whereas we are not obliged to go to the however defined extraordinary lengths to keep such a severely impaired neonate alive, we must not actively end its life. This view has been challenged by many prominent secular ethics. They propose an alternative approach to what is also known as the sanctity of life doctrine in medicine. In their view, we should replace the sanctity of life doctrine with a quality of life ethic," end quote. Now, it is not the case that Christian ethicists say human life is of infinite value. Nobody makes such a statement. Human life is not a matter of economics. Human life, it cannot be taken by other humans because it, of course, is a sin. It's called murder. It's wrong. It's morally wrong. It's obviously morally wrong. It's obviously even more wrong to kill somebody who is unable to defend themselves, as killing babies would be. Now, the quality of life ethic is the scary part. Even if we don't want to talk about these other things, quality of life is a terrible thing to consider, because now you have to have a committee to meet to decide just what a quality life entails, and that those who fall below the threshold may be killed. It will be for their own good. "You see, Mr. Briggs, we have decided your life is not up to our standards, therefore, off with your head." Now, this is absurd and ridiculous and quite frightening, and that it's being championed in a once prominent and once respected journal is disturbing. So now, why would he? I mean, we can go on and on about this paper, and I think it's probably worth writing about at some length too. But I'm more interested in discovering why he came up with this. Now, it turns out, we go to his page. He has a web page. He has two web pages. He has a blog and a personal page. He boasts of saying, I'm quoting, "I have most recently co-edited a popular volume on atheist thought," end quote. So his atheism is driving his murderous tendencies. Now, I say murder because to kill an infant who can't stick up for himself is clearly murder. I have found speeches that Schukirk has made, and we're going to listen to some clips from one speech. I'll have the entire one. It's from YouTube, posted on the show notes. But let's listen to him on the subject of the myth, or so-called myth, that atheists do not hold that human life is sanctified or is sacred.
My profession really is bioethics. I'm a bioethics professor at Queen's. That's what I do for a living. And now, it's certainly true that there is no uncontroversial secular basis for such concepts as equal human dignity from the moment of conception. Sense that at some point in the future, some secular ethicist will come up with a persuasive account for why human life ought to be considered inviolable, possibly even from the moment of conception. But do note that at this point in time, such an account doesn't exist. So atheists who reflect on the matter tend to reject the sanctity of human life doctrine, in fact. So this myth, quite actually, can plausibly be confirmed. Well, we shouldn't be so quick. Because one problem with this myth, of course, is that it assumes human life possesses sanctity in the first place. Most atheists sensibly deny that human life possesses any supernatural property of being sacred, and this may lead them to make or advocate different decisions from, say, traditional Christians, when it comes to issues involving the beginning and end of life. Atheists informed by secular approaches to ethics are more likely to be focused on what will cause or prolong or conversely ameliorate suffering, rather than taking the view that human life possesses some kind of transcendental or supernatural value. In that sense, then, the myth might be considered confirmed.
So it's not a myth at all, and in fact, it's obviously not a myth, as he so much as acknowledges. To ameliorate suffering is a wonderful thing, and it's very difficult to find anybody who is against it. Except let me be against it slightly. We've all heard the phrase, no pain, no gain. We've all heard of people who practice, say, musical instruments or athletic moves and suffer in order to become better at these things. There's a wonderful scene in the movie The Agony and the Ecstasy in which Charlton Heston as Michelangelo is near delirious from his efforts at painting the Sistine Chapel, the roof of the ceiling, I should say, of the Sistine Chapel. And what about suffering induced by sacrifice, as a parent has to a child? Or what about greater love than this no man hath, that a man lay down his life for his friends? What about the ultimate suffering and sacrifice of our Lord? Suffering cannot be the lone criterion from which we judge a quality of life. Here is I've been mispronouncing this gentleman's name. It's Shu Klink. Here he is again.
Atheists, of course, do not think that human lives are valueless. And we are no more likely than anyone else to murder or otherwise harm other human beings. We do not see other humans as insignificant or expendable.
Ah, now that's not true. He does feel, this atheist in particular, does feel that some lives are less worthy than others, that some lives are in fact expendable. Well, that's a glum note on which to end this triumphant return, as I said, podcast. So let's try to brighten it up a little bit if we can by remembering it is Advent and that these evil things, such as Shu Klink is advocating, while expected in our fallen state, are not going to last forever. It is Frank's birthday, Frank Sinatra, that is, so why don't we let him close it out? And I'll see you again, I hope, in a week, if not 2 weeks. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright, round yon in heavenly